This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice, some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Want to talk with Zorba? Pick up the phone and call 800-462-7413. There is a line open for you right now. The callers and Zorba, some interesting research this hour.
Yes, overnight shift. In other words, if you're a shift person, you work morning, you work evening, what happens to you? What happens to your health? And is there evidence that you are at increased risk for cancer?
I'm kind of a shifty person. That's not the same thing, right?
Not the same thing, Tom.
What else?
And half of all doctors, according to a recent survey, are mum about medical mistakes. They know a colleague who made a medical mistake, and they don't bring it up to anybody.
Ouch. Okay, we'll talk about that. An interesting recipe?
Yes, banana-stuffed French toast sandwiches, a dynamite, simple, easy breakfast sandwich that you can make at home that is guaranteed to please everybody who tastes
it. Let me rephrase that. Not interesting. Sounds delicious to me. That's coming up. We have our medical myth buster as well, so you'll want to stay tuned here to Zorba Pastor on Your Health. A listener with us now, Zorba, in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi there.
What's up?
Well, I've got a question for Zorba. I love golf, and I try to get out 3 or 4 times a week. And another problem, not that golf is a problem, but getting out 3 or 4 times a week, I've hit the half-century mark. So unless I take some kind of anti-inflammatory before I play, my hip and back really hurt. And even when I take a leave sometimes, it doesn't help. Well, the story continues. A few weeks ago, my redheaded sister, who's a bit of a know-it-all, asked me if I had any Advil. I said, sure, and rifled through my purse, giving her my very last one. She proceeded to tell me that Advil will ruin my liver. And then, in fact, she said, I've got a whole box of Aleve. You can have it. But so the question for Zorba is, will Aleve ruin my liver? Will Advil ruin my liver? Is there a difference, or what's the story?
Let me ask you first, before Zorba answers that, how often do you believe and trust your know-it-all redheaded sister?
Well, here's the scary part. She listens to NPR every day. So she'll come, we work at the same place, she'll come into the office and she'll spout about the oil supply and 20% of the world's this, that, or the other, and Bush said this, that. And I'll say, Janet, I've just listened to NPR too, so should I believe her?
Well, of course. You don't even need Zorba's help. If she's an NPR regular listener,
and
she knows everything.
And if she's a know-it-all sister, it's obvious she is the one to trust, because it's from her mouth to God's ears. That's what I always say.
Well, you
like
listen to NPR too, Zorba, so your take on this.
Absolutely. I listen to NPR too. Well, first of all, Advil, whether you look at Advil or Aleve, it makes absolutely no difference. These are anti-inflammatory drugs. One doesn't ruin the liver, or as a lot of my patients say, my liver is going to fall out. I have never seen a liver fall out of a body, but obviously that's what it is. My liver is going to fall out. And all the anti-inflammatories can affect kidney function and liver function. They all do it. It's kidney, liver, kidney, liver, kidney, liver. But 99% of the people, 98% of the people tolerate it. The ones who don't tolerate it are usually senior citizens, people who have kidney disease, people who have diabetes with serious disease. And those people, we monitor these medications by taking regular kidney and liver function tests, but we still only do it once a year because it's not a common side effect from these. So you have to go back to your sister and say, sister, Advil, Aleve, exactly the same in the liver. You might know it all, but I know more.
Let me just ask you, how many of these do you take in a day?
Well, usually only when I go golfing, and that's probably 3 or 4 times a week, so that's 2 a day. And sometimes they have no effect whatsoever.
Right. But that's the way it is with anti-inflammatories. Frankly, the difference between Advil and Aleve, the big difference, first of all, they are two different drugs. But Aleve is a twice-a-day drug. I like it better because it's twice a day versus ibuprofen, which is three times a day. So I recommend to people 1 to 2 Aleve tablets. It only says one on the bottle, but you can take 1 to 2 Aleve tablets twice daily. That'll make a big difference.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes it works. You take it an hour before you go out on the golf course, and all of a sudden you can golf better without pain, and that's the way to have it.
Uh-huh. Does it help not hitting the trees?
Yes, it does. I guarantee that if you take it, you know, the trees. But, you know, the trees on a golf course have the gravity. You know, they attract the balls. That's why the balls hit the trees.
They do. Well, it's pretty scary when you hit the ball. You think you hit the ball forward and it goes 20 yards backward.
Been there, done that.
Okay. Well, so the one thing I do know now is that Zorba Pastor actually knows more than my sister.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
800-462-7413. On to Nashville, Tennessee we go. Hello.
Hello. I think I've got a tough one for you about adult onset itching.
Adult onset itching. Okay, I'm ready.
Well, I'm 65, and 3 years ago I had a knee operation, and after a couple of days it started itching under the bandage, which was understandable. So I thought it would stop when it came off and a couple of days later. But it continued down my calf and then to the other calf and up my legs and eventually got on my upper torso and back. And so I went to a dermatologist, and he gave me all the stuff about the wrong kind of soap and keeping it moist and stuff like that, and a mild cortisone cream. And it still didn't get any better. But then after about a month, my wife started itching similarly. So we went to see a dermatologist together, and he tried to look for signs of scabies, but he couldn't find any. But he gave us the treatment for it anyway. After a while, hers went away. But I've had mine for 2.5 years.
Okay, so when you're talking about the cortisone, you mean prescription or over-the-counter medication?
Yeah, prescription. At first, triamcinolone, and then the one that's been best has been fluocinonide.
Okay,
cream
so those are two high-potency, medium to high-potency steroid creams that we often use. A type of soap that you use? What kind of soap?
I'll switch to Dove.
To Dove. Okay, Dove is pretty good to do that. And you've been how many dermatologists?
Five,
you see? You see, Tom was sitting there and he thought, oh, well, how does he answer that question? You've been to 5 dermatologists. Okay, so there are 5 dermatologists. What are the chances I'm going to come up with a diagnosis here?
I told you it was hard.
What are the chances? Over the radio airwaves, moi, you know, it's Zorba on one side. It's got 5 dermatologists
but you're,
on the other side.
You're Super Zorba.
I'm Super Zorba, and I'm the NPR doc. That's exactly it. So I can come up with the answer. Have faith in my answer. Okay, you've got 5 dermatologists. What did they all say, or what did they say individually? You've got 5. What kind of diagnosis do you
have? They have 3 words that they use all the time.
Okay.
You go to them, you say you're itching, and they say, well, you got eczema, which means itching. Or you go to them, and they say you got pruritus, which means itching. Or you go to them and say you got itching, and they say you got dermatitis, which means itching. So if you go to them and tell them you got itching, then they tell you you got itching.
I have to tell you something.
You got itching.
That is so close to the truth, you know. When I was in medical school, they said, oh, go into dermatology. You can't cure them, you can't kill them, and they keep on coming back.
yeah, there you go.
That's a very funny thing.
And I've also been taking antihistamine, doxepin, 2 a day, and hydroxyzine, 4 a day.
Now, doxepin is not an antihistamine. It's an antidepressant.
Oh, yeah.
It helps with itching.
Well, for itching.
So 5 dermatologists, and I love that they basically have said you've got itching. Well, you've got itching. That's exactly it. Part of the problem is I shouldn't laugh at the afflicted. Yeah. You know, I'm nowhere going to get, you know, we've got the email police, and they're going to come and say, how could you laugh at the guy with itching? But you're laughing too, so it's acceptable. One of the problems is we get to a point where we don't know exactly what we can do, and we have a variety of things we do. a high-potency, medium-potency steroid creams, change the soap, telling you shower less often, don't do it every day, do it every 2 or 3 days. Look at the clothing that you're wearing. You know, stay away from synthetic fabrics. Look at more cotton fabrics. And even with all of that done, we still have people who itch. And frankly, we don't know what it is. And there's some people who theorize, especially if you can't see much of a rash, that this is actually a problem internally. And an itch can be associated with the pain fibers. It's the same neurological fiber for pain can be present with itching. And you may not have any of these things wrong with your skin. Like you said, they have three words for it. One is itching, one is eczema, one is, and one is dermatitis. And basically it means an itch. So I've got two questions. Have you ever taken a gabapentin, Neurontin?
No.
Okay, I have a recommendation. I think we should treat the pain fiber that I think is being activated with the itch. So I have a completely different recommended. Mm. The creams, the emollients, maybe they're doing something, but they obviously haven't cured you. What we have to do is stop the itching at the source. You're on two anti-itching pills. I would recommend a totally different pill. It's called Neurontin. That's the name brand, or gabapentin. 300 to 600 milligrams, or a lower dose, but 300 milligrams three times daily. Treat the fiber in the central nervous system that may be activating with the itch, and the itch may disappear, and basically the rash may stay there and not be itchy. The itching that bothers you.
Be ready to be a little groggy while you're taking this.
A little groggy, and that lasts for about a week or two. And then most people, 95% of the people, can tolerate it. Start out with 300 milligrams at bedtime. After a couple days, move it up to twice a day and then three times a day. Talk to your doctor. Gabapentin, that's what I would recommend. See if it works and call us back.
Well, that's great. I'll try anything.
Thank you for your call.
Well, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
800-462-7413. Now, this was scary when you mentioned it, Zorba. Some research which apparently suggests that those who work during the night can be classified as probable cancer cause or
well,
at risk?
Well, the issue has to do with whether or not shift work and cancer are related. Now, think about shift work. You know, you work at night, you sleep during the day.
Yeah.
Okay. So when we look at shift work as a group, and there are a lot of people who are in shift work, nurses, policemen, a lot of people who are in the IT industry, they work at night, they sleep during the daytime. So they looked at this. There may also be an issue with melatonin production. We produce melatonin at night when we're sleeping, when it's dark. In the daytime, we don't tend to produce it. And if we sleep during the daytime, we can produce it if we shut the window. So melatonin might be effective.
Well, isn't that what they're guessing is the problem?
Well, they're guessing. It may also be the problem that we're looking at here. It may not be melatonin. It may be what you're doing and what you're eating. What they found was that the rates of breast cancer and prostate cancer appear to be higher among shift workers. And this has been something that they've looked at for many
workers.
Years. Yeah. And shift workers work at night at some time in their day. I mean, they're shift workers. So some of the time they're working at night, usually some of the time they're working during the day. Very few shift workers just work at nighttime.
Okay.
It's a really, really tiny percentage of the population.
But isn't the working at night what they see as the problem? Here?
Maybe it's the switch between the night and the day. It may not just be the night. In other words, usually shift workers work at night, and then they work during the day. And they're looking at the incidence of cancer, and it may be the body's clock. But I think the real issue, I look at it as this. If you're a shift worker, get a good night's sleep. Shut the windows. Make sure the windows are down, the shades are down.
A good day's sleep.
A good day's sleep is crucial, and you've got to really activate that. And that's very hard if you live in a busy city, in an apartment, if you have to put in earplugs. It's hard to shut out that noise that may be on. That's number one. Number two, think about your lunch that you're bringing with you to your shift work and try to make it good. You know, the stuff you get out of vending machines is generally the stuff you get out of vending machines. You know, it's not great stuff. High fat, high salt, high caloric, high carbohydrate food. Bring your lunch with you and make it nutritious, because I think there's a nutrition issue. And the third thing is find out how you're going to get exercise if you're a shift worker, because we know all these things affect cancer rates. So why not really look at those things that we can
alter? Does the production of melatonin take place in the daytime if you're in a dark space while you're sleeping?
Well, yeah, it seems to be be produced more during the daytime as long as it's dark. The darkness seems to do it. Yeah. But we don't know if melatonin is the issue or not. I mean, that's a theory. I think it's probably much more complex than simply that. And there are a number of hormones that change with day and night with a circadian rhythm. It's not just melatonin. It's cortisol and a bunch of other hormones. And these things affect our body and obviously have effects on cancer.
I know in our society we need people to work at all times, day or night, 24/7, all of that.
That's right.
But I'll tell you what, if I'm a nighttime worker, not just based on this, but I want a raise. I want if I'm taking a greater risk because of that,
there
I want
go.
More money yeah. for
well,
it.
Well, recognize it as a risk. That's a good question. So are you going to do that with your next job?
I'll tell you what, my next job ain't going to be at night.
That's right.
800-462-7413. 1-800-462-7413. To a listener now, Zorba in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help you?
Well, I listen to your show all the time. I really enjoy it. Thanks for being on the air.
Well, thank you.
Well, I bought a weekend cabin a few months ago in the Daniel Boone National Forest. And the cabin has this big propane heater that sits in the middle of the family room that I'm guessing is probably over 50 years old. It's a big brown tin box, and it has a manufacturer label on it calling it Warm Morning. Well, I'm afraid Warm Morning is a little too old, and it might make the house a little too warm one of these days by blowing up or something. So I've been considering replacing Warm Morning with one of those ventless gas heaters that you can install on a wall and can get from your local hardware store. Well, here's my question. I know you're not supposed to use your gas stove to heat your house if your electricity goes out, and I'm wondering what makes this ventless heater so safe but not your gas stove? I mean, don't they both put out bad carbons, monoxide or dioxide?
Do you know about that stuff, sir?
Oh, absolutely. Let me tell you, they do not put out carbon monoxide. That stuff kills you. Carbon monoxide is a deadly gas. It kills you. The deadly gas occurs basically when things are not oxidized completely. So a good example is taking your charcoal grill and grilling in the house. Great way to produce carbon monoxide. Great way to fall off the planet. Everyone in the house. And that's why we don't grill with charcoal inside the house, because it produces carbon monoxide. Or in the garage.
But now we hear all the time about people that have these heaters in their homes and dying from it.
Well, they die of carbon monoxide because the heaters there's something wrong with the heater. In other words, if it produces carbon monoxide, there's something wrong. There's a very easy way to find out if it produces carbon monoxide. It costs $25 and it's called a carbon monoxide indicator. You plug it into the wall, and if there's carbon monoxide in the house, it buzzes. Mm-hmm. And every single person who has a heater in their house that does not heat with electric heat should have one. Because if there's something wrong with your furnace, if there's something wrong with your stove, you will know that because the thing will buzz. So that's an easy way to know. So, you know, what's the name of the old stove that's in there, Happy Morning?
Warm Morning. It keeps you warm in the morning.
Warm Morning, and it's 50 years old. Has anyone ever looked at Warm Morning in the last 50 years to see if it's vented properly and if there's a leak?
Yeah, it's pretty old, and I think that's why I got such a good deal on the place, frankly. But
the last people died in the house, and their relatives wanted to get rid of it. No, but doing it with a ventless heater is fine. Basically, if you look at your oven, let's take you have an oven that runs on natural gas. You know, it really is ventless because the gas is completely oxidized. You don't have any carbon monoxide. You produce carbon dioxide, which is okay, but there's no carbon monoxide that's actually produced. So the answer is you're okay with this. Get a carbon monoxide indicator also to look at it. And why don't you put your gas stove on when your electricity goes off? That's a good question, because when our electricity is going off in the house, we put the gas stove on because the furnace won't go on because of the thermostat.
Well, so that's not as bad as they say then, I guess.
I think the reason people say don't put it on is it may cause a fire. I mean, I put it on in the house because you've got a flame that isn't protected and it may cause a fire, but it doesn't actually produce carbon monoxide. No, not if it's working properly. Now, if it's working improperly, that's a different issue. Once again, the carbon monoxide indicator for $25 tells you in the house if you've got carbon monoxide, so you can test it yourself.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Good luck. Thanks. Stay warm. Stay warm.
Do you have one of those things, those $25
things? You bet. Don't you?
We should get one.
Wait a minute. You don't have one in your house?
No.
Oh, my gosh and golly. Everyone should have one. Do you heat your house in the winter?
No. We put on lots of sweaters and coats.
They're $25. How can you have a smoke detector in your house?
Let's take it away from me and help out Walter from Racine, Wisconsin. Seems Walter is looking after his dad, who's 88 years old and in excellent health. Here's the quandary, though. Seems one doc recommended that Walter's pop get a colonoscopy, but when they went to schedule the appointment, another doc told Walter that his dad, this is his 88-year-old dad, was too old for the procedure. Can this be?
Well, of course it can be. You know, the issue is, especially with colonoscopy, at what point are you not saving lives?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big issue. There's no absolute answer to this at all with colonoscopy. The data shows clearly that people 50 years of age to 75, maybe 80 years of age, but certainly 75, you save lives by doing colonoscopy, picking up the polyps, looking at the polyps, removing the polyps so that the ones that are prone to cancer, you know, won't cause cancer. We don't know in 88-year-olds whether we're saving lives. So we give them the preparation, which isn't fun. You know, got to drink this gallon of water and, you know, and have diarrhea all night. Then we put them in sort of in this twilight zone sleep, which has a risk to it, more of a risk when you're 88. We find a polyp, and then we don't know whether or not we're actually saving lives because an 88-year-old with a polyp may not get more. So on the whole, most people say we stop screening at the age of 80. It's a very arbitrary date. Some people say, well, that's wrong. You don't want to stop at 80. You can go up higher, like to 88, if the person is active and vibrant, their memory is, you know, is in good shape, and you think they're going to live another 10 years. But the reality is you only need it once every 10 years, so you may be saving somebody from a cancer when they're 98.
Yeah.
So there's a little – this is where the art of medicine plays a role.
Yeah. I've had a couple of colonoscopies. Yes. You've had a colonoscopy.
Yeah, I love them. They're great.
When you're 88 – are you going to get a colonoscopy?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Let me tell you what I'm going to be doing at 88. I'm going to have a high-fat diet, sitting on a beach in the sun, getting a suntan. That's what I'm going to do. I'm probably going to have 2 to 3 cigars a day because even though I stopped smoking in the 70s, I never stopped losing the desire for the car. On a beach somewhere,
and there will
not
be,
thinking
there,
at all about preventive
there
medicine.
There will be no medical journals anywhere.
No
in
medical
the
journals. I've got novels on one side. I'm sitting there in the pool. My wife is with me, and we're enjoying the good life. That's it.
You're never too old to let us know your thoughts. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Lots more of your questions coming up. First, though, our recipe, and don't forget our medical myth buster coming up later here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. We have a line open for you right now if you have a question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, it is recipe time, and for a change, no listener recipe. This one from the kitchen of Zorba Pastor, prepared by assistant, or should I say associate chef, Adam Friedrich,
who doubles as our sous chef. He's the sous chef.
Okay.
He's the executive chef.
This one sounds and smells delicious because Adam has placed it right between us for banana stuffed French toast sandwiches.
If you are looking for something to have for breakfast on the weekend, when you have friends over, relatives, company, kids, or just for a special time, think about this sandwich, and I will tell you, you will be delighted. It's a delightful, simple, easy sandwich, and your guests will say, ooh,
yeah, this
that's
is not
really
a pick-it-up sandwich because you're going to want to throw a little syrup on here and eat it with a fork.
Yeah, unless you want to pick it up in a sloppy way.
You know,
you could do that, but that would be it. So,
let's do it.
Okay, start out with 2 large bananas ripe and cut into quarters.
2 big bananas ripe and cut into quarters.
2 teaspoons of sugar.
2 little tea sugar.
1/2 cup of non-fat milk. That's skim milk.
Half a cup of non-fat or skim milk.
That's right. I mean, that's the new name for skim milk. It's called non-fat milk.
Okay.
Does anyone ever call it non-fat milk?
No, it's skim milk.
It's skim milk. Yeah. That's what we call it here. Two large eggs.
Two big eggs.
Teaspoon of vanilla extract.
A little tea, vanilla extract.
Half tablespoonful of ground cinnamon.
Half a big tea, ground cinnamon.
Yes, and use a good cinnamon. I mean, if you're going to use it, I mean, sometimes you can buy these big jars and they seem to last forever, but they eventually lose their potency.
Mm-hmm.
So use a good cinnamon. Non-stick cooking spray you'll need.
Non-stick cooking spray.
You'll need some powdered sugar for dusting.
Powdered sugar for dusting.
And if you want to garnish it, 8 large strawberries.
8 large strawberries.
So,
now, this portion we have here has, I see Adam has put no powdered sugar on.
That's right. And
do you see any strawberries here?
No, I don't. So he has failed in this part and gets minus 2 points.
So when you do it, it's going to be a lot better
it's going
than
to be pretty,
Adam
well, yeah,
did
but,
for
we
us.
Have, but we have overcome that with some Mrs. Butterworth's original syrup, which we are going to place on top of this.
Okay.
And frankly, the Mrs. Butterworth's original syrup will take care of this in the end time. Or for that matter, any maple syrup we happen to have.
Okay.
Okay, let's make it. First, preheat the oven to 350 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
Place the banana quarters into a bowl and sprinkle with sugar. Mash up the bananas and then spread the mixture very evenly over 4 pieces of bread, whole wheat bread if you want to, or good white bread if you want to. You could have a sourdough bread. They all have different tastes. Or challah, which is an egg bread. And then top it with the remaining 4 pieces of bread. Tom is now eating while we're talking, and he is now, you heard him, good. In a deep dish, whisk the milk, eggs, vanilla extract, and cinnamon together, and dip each sandwich into the egg mixture and let it soak for 30 seconds, then flip it over. Then spray the griddle, a large skillet will work just as well in batches, with cooking spray, and heat it over medium heat. Add the sandwiches and cook until golden brown on both sides. That's about 2 minutes per side. Then transfer the sandwiches to a baking sheet and bake for another 8 to 10 minutes. Dust with powdered sugar and garnished with chopped strawberries, and you've got a dynamite breakfast sandwich. 181 calories, not much from the fat point of view, only 3 grams of fat, and of course, it's got some protein. In fact, it's got 5 grams of protein because of the eggs, so bon appetit. How was it?
Oh, it's delicious. It's a really good-tasting breakfast food. French toast, of course, with syrup, but the bananas are really a nice touch in there. And I can just imagine with the nice strawberries on there and the powdered sugar, this is a really good breakfast recipe.
You know what, Tom? You have become the resident food critic of the show. I love it. I love the way you describe it. Absolutely great. When it comes to something like this, you really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a really good breakfast. You'll want the recipe, and we're happy to send it to you. Just address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin. Our zip code is 53706.
Or come to our website at www.zorbapastor.org. You can get this recipe, other fun recipes, and you can sign up for our podcast.
Our phone number is 800-462-7413, so if you have a question for Zorba, that's the number you'll call, 800-462-7413. Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener now in Springfield, Missouri. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Not a whole lot. I've been working out with a friend lately. We've started lifting weights. And we've been looking for a good, like a health bar that we can eat just kind of to supplement some, I don't know, muscle protein needs, I guess.
So you want some help from Zorba on diet stuff, did you say?
No, on a power bar.
Protein and health bars. We're also students, and we kind of need something in between classes, you know, as a good pick-me-up or after our workout, just, you know, before we head to class.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Something light.
So let me give you a way to sort of look at these power bars and see what they are, because for the most part, many of the power bars are basically enriched candy. That's what they are. Mm-hmm. They're candy. They've got syrup in it. They've got sugars in it. And what they do is they increase the protein with peanuts. I mean, that's what they really are. They're a peanut soy-infused bar. On the other hand, when you look at it and you look at what your needs are, you say, what are my needs? I'm not going to have veggies at the end of a workout because that doesn't give me any energy. There's not much carbohydrate to metabolize, and there certainly is no protein there at all. So what you want to do is go to the store, look at the power bars, and look at the ingredients. They're very small on the power bar. They're not the usual box. They're sort of in the wrapper way up there, and you've got to read it. And what you want to do is look for the one with the highest protein, the lowest calories, and the lowest fat. And that's the power bar to choose. So I'm not going to give you any names. There's some of them out there that are high protein and high fat. And there are a lot of them out there that are high protein, high fat, and high sugar. And that's not what you want. You want one that has significant protein, lowest fat of those that you see, and lowest sugar, and then try it. And having one, you know, they're generally about 220 to about 280 calories will be just fine to have after that, and that's what you can have. Now, if you want to avoid the issues with fat and sugar, what you do is you get a shake. And you can get, of course, you can buy shakes in the store that are protein shakes that are made with soy protein. And a shake will often have less sugar and less fat. But again, what you have to do is you've got to read the label to see. But that's a way of prospecting what's a good bar and what's a bad bar. And doing that afterwards, I think, is just fine because you burn up those calories. You need that protein after a workout.
What have you been doing up to now?
Well, I kind of wait a little while. I come home and get cleaned up generally, and then, you know, about an hour later I'm eating. But I've been advised to, like, intake some protein just after my workout. So a handful of nuts, or, you know, like a quick turkey sandwich or something.
By the way, I have to tell you, that is a great thing to do. You know, turkey is a, you know, especially white meat turkey, but even dark meat turkey, which has more fat. But white meat turkey is an excellent source of protein. It's animal protein. It's excellent. It doesn't have a lot of calories. If you're looking for pure protein, that's what you go for. You can also have skim milk. Skim milk is a good example of something that has some sugar but has a lot of protein. And those often are better than the power candy bar, and that's what it is. Think of it, you know, they call them power bars, but these are candy bars that are protein enriched, but they're still candy bars. Good luck and keep exercising.
All right, thank you.
Sure, thanks a lot for the call. I love hearing about and talking about exercise. And thinking about exercise. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. A listener in El Paso, Texas now. Hi.
Hi, guys.
What's up?
Oh, well, I have a question. And before I go into my question, I'd like to agree with Tom. I also do like to think about exercise. Mostly just think about it. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately. And that's probably part of what I'm calling about. I actually have a question about olive oil, and I just recently had an annual checkup done, and my bad cholesterol was a little high, and well, I'm actually already taking medication for high blood pressure, so what I want to do is try to, you know, get that bad cholesterol down without having to take more medication, you know, and so I heard from a friend who just swears that taking a tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil daily will help decrease the bad cholesterol and increase the good. Now, my question is, is there any truth to this claim, or is it just basically a myth, or you know what I'm saying?
Well, the claim has been around for quite some time, and the reason is it really has to do with the HDL, or the good cholesterol. And we know the people around the Mediterranean Sea, France, the Greeks, Italians, the Spanish, who eat much more olive oil than we do, tend to have higher HDLs. And we think it's a bit from exercise and a bit from the olive oil. It may do something for that, although there's no scientific proof. It won't do anything at all for the LDL or bad cholesterol. But let's talk a bit about that. How high is your bad cholesterol?
You know, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was like about 170 or something.
170. That's a bit high. And how old are you?
33.
33. Do you smoke cigarettes?
No, I don't.
No. Do you drink excess alcohol, more than 2 drinks a day?
No alcohol at all.
Okay. Do you exercise?
Not as much as I should.
Not as much as you should. Typical American, we all say the same thing, not as much as we should, except for those who exercise as much as they should. The reality is you probably don't need a drug at all for what you have, but diet is important. So what you want to do is give it a full fourth diet, and you want to substitute good oil for bad oil. So you want to substitute olive oil for saturated fat. That'll do it. You want to decrease the amount of oil that you get in your diet and look towards your overall fat to go on a more cholesterol prudent diet, because that may lower your cholesterol. Now, some people are very, very diet sensitive. They really go on a stricter diet, and they really can lower their cholesterol quite well. Other people, it doesn't do anything at all. In other words, you go on a lower diet, and it doesn't do anything at all, and they may need to be on medicines. Do you have a family history for premature heart attacks from mom or dad or anybody?
No, my mother does have high blood pressure, though, but, I mean, it's been recent, you know. She's in her 60s now. So.
Okay. So I basically think the treatment of high blood pressure, key, you know, it's really a key issue and stay on that. You know, if I had an LDL cholesterol of 170, I definitely would not go on a medicine at all at your age. What I would do is watch it. I'd try to stick to a diet, do the other things, and I would follow it over a period of years. There may be a time that I would go back on it. But if you want to look at the guidelines, what you do is you can Google the word heart attack risk calculator. That's what you Google, and you'll get a calculator from the National Institute of Health or from the Framingham Heart Study.
Very good.
I pronounced it right.
Very good, yeah.
The Framingham Heart Study. You put in your age, your blood pressure, your treatment, and so on, and you put in your HDL cholesterol and your total cholesterol, and it'll tell you what your risk is, and write down on a little sheet of paper what your risk is, and then alter your cholesterol. Pretend you're bringing it down 20 or 30 or 40 points and put it in, and it'll tell you what bang for your buck you get by going on a cholesterol drug. And generally at your tender age of 33, most people would not recommend, unless you've got a strong family history, a cholesterol lowering drug. But diet exercise.
Gotcha. Thank you very much,
guys. Oh, our pleasure.
Yeah, we appreciate it. And that link to the heart calculator is on our resources page on our website. More of the program coming up here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again, if you want to talk with Zorba, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, some disconcerting research suggesting that half of you docs failed to report mistakes on the part of other doctors.
Right, and that really is a big issue. Within every hospital, there are committees called quality assurance committees that look at medical errors, they look at mistakes, they have a way of actually talking to physicians and then trying to not necessarily discipline them, but frankly, look at these mistakes and see how do you make things better, who should get reported, and so on. But what this particular study published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, very important journal, found that 46% of the physicians admitted that they knew of a serious medical error had been made and didn't tell the authorities, whoever that is, be it the state medical board or the quality assurance committee, about it. And then when you break it up, you find some very interesting things. You find, for instance, that medical incompetence by internists and family docs was much more likely to be reported than among cardiologists and surgeons.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So there was a difference. And most doctors said, 85% say doctors should tell their patients or relatives about medical errors, but when it comes to practice, it's only 30% who actually told patients about medical errors that actually occurred. So it's very clear that doctors do not practice what they preach.
Yeah. Well, I guess this is not really surprising, because there is a kind of a family community amongst physicians, I would guess, just as there is amongst any other work group, right. And you hate to rat out your buddies.
Right, right.
But it's a really serious health concern.
No, it's very serious, especially when we consider the Institute of Medicine made a report in the year 2000 that said that they think about 100,000 people a year die from medical errors in the hospital. So it's serious because we want to reduce the number of medical errors, and we also want to take physicians who need retraining to be retrained, physicians who are marginal to get more retraining, and frankly, physicians who aren't competent to not be trained, you know, to say you're incompetent, you can't do this, you have to do something else.
Yeah. Well, one wonders how many, for example, firefighters would turn in a companion who wasn't doing the job correctly, how many radio broadcasters would go to the boss
say
so.
No, I mean, absolutely.
We tend not
absolutely.
To do that.
But these are not life and death issues.
That's right. It's
these
a little more important in your business. That's right.
And so the real issue is not to, quote, go to the authorities. The real issue is develop situations within a hospital and committee structures within clinics so that you can go to the medical director and you can say, hey, there's a problem here. How do we do it? And it's remediation of that problem is just as important as essentially discovering the problem itself. But it's clear that this is a problem because doctors aren't doing it.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, a listener now in Vernon, New Jersey. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine. How can we help you?
I have a little bit of a developing issue with a thing called ceramic lung. I've been involved in the boat repair and auto body trade for probably about 8 years, and I've recently left it, having been told that my lungs are not healthy. So I'm really looking for potential alternative medicine or any exercises or any chance of finding a way to correct this and get my wind back, if you will.
Yeah, Zorba, I've got to say, I don't have a clue, and I imagine many of our other listeners don't have a clue either. What is ceramic
lung? Yeah, tell me a little bit about what you're calling ceramic lung.
I was told that the incredible amount of dust and fumes, high volatility from auto body paint and resins and styrene-type polyester and epoxy resins.
Okay.
Even with respirators and all the best filtration can still cause drastic allergies, type symptoms. In the morning, I sound like a coffee pot.
Okay, so in other words, you have changes in your lung volume consistent with something similar to chronic obstructive lung disease.
Right, COPD is another thing that I was suspicious of, but I haven't really been given a determination of whether or not that's
right.
One
and
of
it
the...
may, and it may be similar. So you've been in this business for how long?
Let's see. I actually taught auto body and actually exposed myself to a much lesser degree for a few years, but I'd have to say about 9 years.
Okay, so about nine. Are you a smoker?
No, I'm not.
Okay, did you ever smoke cigarettes at all?
Yes, I did.
Okay, for how long?
A couple of months.
Okay, a couple of months is not long at all.
Well.
Not long at all. So you didn't smoke for like 10 or 20 years?
Because that's
one issue. History of asthma in the family at all?
Yes, both sides.
Both sides, okay. Do people have trouble breathing because of their asthma? Do they have adult onset problems?
Yes, they do.
Okay, so part of what you have then may be this genetic predisposition from, you know, from people in the family who have asthma.
Sure.
I mean, that's an important issue. What are you on? Are you on a steroid inhaler that you inhale?
I was on an inhaler, and I didn't like the way it made me feel.
Mm-hmm. What kind of inhaler were you on?
It was I think it was Primatene.
Yeah, Primatene is awful. It's awful.
Yeah, I don't
It's awful. Primatene is not the inhaler. It's the inhaler that should be taken off the market, and it's never going to be taken off the market. The feds will never take it off the market. It's awful stuff. A steroid inhaler you take twice a day, coat your lungs with a steroid. You want to make sure it doesn't go in the back of the mouth. You sort of gargle to make sure it's not in the back of the mouth. And often a steroid inhaler will make a difference. Have you been on that at all?
I had pneumonia a couple years back.
Okay.
And it was touch and go there for a while, but the inhalers helped, and it was a two-inhaler process. I'm pretty sure one of them was a steroid.
Yeah, it was a two-inhaler process. That was it. Of course, you can't tell if that's working there, but that's one thing to look at. One thing to look at is, do I need a steroid inhaler, and is that going to make things better? But the real issue is, when you look at all the things that you breathe in within the auto body shop with the respirators, and you look at what OSHA has tried to bring in, for someone such as yourself with the predisposition to asthma, this is not the best occupation for you.
That's, like I said, I'm out of the trade. trade now.
That's
strictly a hobbyist.
Yeah, but you're a hobbyist meaning how much are you around these chemicals?
A couple of weekends in the spring, and that's about it.
Okay, so not much as a hobbyist. Do it outside, so basically.
Absolutely, as much as I can. Well, even the neighbors don't like that, but.
Yeah, even the neighbors don't like it.
They don't like the smell.
So the way to maximize your lungs, first of all, you've got to, if this happened with your job, you've got to document it from a workman's comp point of view. It's really important. From a lung point of view of maximizing your lung function, you want to stay away from all those things that, are bad for lung function. Smoke. Other chemicals, other environments. And then from a functional point of view, how do you make it better? Steroid inhalers, regular aerobic exercise improves lung function. Being at the right weight improves lung function. So in other words, you want regular aerobic exercise, not just stretching exercise, but aerobic exercise because you want to maximize that.
Okay.
And you want to make sure that you get down to the proper weight. And that's going to maximize your function. Then after you do that and you're at tip-top shape for 4 to 6 months, then get a test done and you'll see what your baseline is. And then you're going to be more likely to know what your risk is. And more importantly, what's your risk over the next 10 and 20 years? Good lung doctor will tell you
you're
that.
You're saying shovel a lot of snow, essentially.
Shovel a lot of snow and run to the shovel.
Run to the shovel. I do try to jog. I've got to say the cold air, as much as I'm told not to do, it actually feels a little bit more relief.
Oh, yeah.
It'll help me expectorate, whereas warm air sitting in a gym on a treadmill is more around humidity and body odor than as opposed to fresh air.
It's whatever feels good and feels right to you. But that's an important part. These things, you've got to hit all of those different realms in order to take care of your problem. So thank you so much for calling.
All right, and thank you all very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
800-462-7413. Zorba, let's get to our medical myth buster. Our myth today deals with mixing your spirits. There are apparently a number of people here in this country that believe that mixing beer consumption with hard alcohol consumption will make you sick. Is this a myth?
Yeah, haven't you heard things like that?
No.
Oh, I have heard. If you're drinking margaritas, don't go to, don't go vodka.
Well, Zorba,
I mean, this is what,
When
I go out to the bars and I drink those margaritas, they say don't have Red Bull and vodka shots with your margaritas.
But Zorba, you and I are of a certain age. We grew up not necessarily doing this, but certainly knowing about a shot and a beer.
Yeah, a shot and a beer.
Am I wrong?
Yes, but I have to admit,
nobody ever suggested. I mean, you could get obviously drunk doing this. But
yes.
Nobody ever suggested it would make you otherwise ill.
Yes, that's true. I have to tell you though, I've actually never had a shot at a beer myself.
I haven't either. But you certainly. That's a long-standing.
It's a long-standing thing. In fact, it's sort of the joke in our house: a shot at a beer. But the question is, will beer before liquor? There's this old phrase: beer before liquor, never been sicker. And so, it's kind of interesting. And what happens is this. People who drink beer and end the night with hard liquor, and that's kind of the way that they do it. They may be drinking 4 beers, 6 beers, 7 beers, 8 beers. They're kind of coming down from their beer high. They often, in order to maintain their high, will then drink a couple of shots. And so they get sicker from a hangover. And that's what it is. It's that it's just more common for people to drink
beer. But that's because they're drinking more alcohol.
Absolutely.
It doesn't matter whether it's beer or...
Not at all. It's not the order that counts. It's how many ounces of alcohol go into your bloodstream. That determines how sick you are. And people swear, oh, I can't drink that because that makes me sick. Those individual differences are another matter. Those are individual differences that occur with what people are drinking. But no, doesn't matter which is first and which is second.
Have a myth you'd like Zorba to bust? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our number again, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Boise, Idaho. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, I had a question. My husband and I are currently trying to conceive a child.
Mm-hmm.
I just stopped birth control about 9 weeks ago or so, and I've been told so many conflicting reports about how long it takes fertility to return. I was on the NuvaRing for 4.5 years. And I've been told that NuvaRing is different than the old pills that they used to have and even the new pills now because the hormone doses are different. I've been told like 10 different things, so I'm really confused.
Well, Zorba has the definitive answer to your question.
I love it. I love it. The definitive answer. There's conflicting evidence because, frankly, there's conflicting evidence. So the first thing I want to say, the reason that you've got 10 different answers is because there basically are 10 different answers. But we know that when you begin to use hormonal therapy for birth control, I don't care if it's the ring, the patch, the pill, or the shot, no matter which way you do it, you decrease your fertility over the next 6 to 12 months. In other words, the number of times that you will actually have an egg and, during your cycle, when you look from a statistical point of view of 1,000 women, is decreased. Now, how long is it decreased? There's not a lot of research that really is definitive research where you have people who stop that and can say, well, it's these number of months for the ring and these number of months for the pill. Frankly, a hormone is a hormone is a hormone. Now, it's true the ring has less hormone because it's a ring that's in there, and we use lower doses than we used years ago. And so it may be theoretically true that you'll return to fertility in a more, in a more timely fashion, but the data ain't there. In other words, it doesn't say that. So generally, my recommendation to people is over the next 6 months, I think that's the best guide. You're going to have decreased fertility. It doesn't mean you should stop having sex and trying to have a baby, but it just means you may not get pregnant right away.
Okay.
Can we say the word sex on public radio? It's hard to say. So
no.
We say the word having relations.
No.
But if you look, we can't say the word sex.
No.
Okay. But I'm a doctor. So if I say sex,
then it's okay. Yeah.
So if you look at people who are trying to have sex, not using birth control, and they want to get pregnant, 80% are roughly pregnant at the end of a year. For women on the pill, it's probably reduced to 70% because of that first six-month period.
Okay.
So I would continue having relations, basically, and you'll get pregnant. Pregnant sooner or later.
Okay.
I'm not gonna say did he answer your question?
No. It wasn't definitive. It wasn't, but it was a review of what's going on within medicine.
Thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Quickly before we go, Zorba, let's take this comment from a listener named Lenny. Not too long ago, we were chatting about kraut juice, and you asked the rhetorical question, who would drink kraut juice? You remember?
Oh, I do remember.
Well, Lenny writes, I wondered the same thing, but when my brother had a broken jaw that was wired shut, I saw him drink it. He said, try 3 days of nothing but orange juice, apple juice, and pineapple juice, and kraut juice seems like the nectar of the gods. Now you know. Anyway.
Oh, that is so funny.
If your jaw's wired
so
shut,
funny.
You can still have your thoughts heard. Send us an email with your comments, questions, and tips.
Zorba@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Call day or night with your questions for Zorba at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director, and Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. G.G. Holland fills your recipe requests, and our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.